You heard James Judd leading the Florida Philharmonic Orchestra. Those were symphonic dances from West Side Story, legendary music from the great American composer Leonard Bernstein. I'm Melissa Dundas.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Attention Henry Ford students. The college's winter 2020 semester is fast approaching. Here are some important dates to remember. October 14th, winter 2020 schedule becomes available in the HFC self-service. October 28th, priority registration begins. October 14th, open registration for all students begins. December 23rd, HFC closes for end-of-the-year holidays. January 13th, classes begin. And January 19th is the last day of late registration. Please visit hfcc.edu for more information.
And Kendall, I'm going to let you introduce yourself. That's the best way, you know, then we'll go on from there.
Okay. All right. Well, hello. My name is Kendall Owens. I am a student still. I go to Western Michigan University, double majoring in dance and nursing. I have 1 year left, so that's good. I'm excited to graduate. I have a nonprofit organization. It's called New Generation Fine Arts Foundation, and it's a fine arts organization dedicated to promoting and sustaining fine arts in the Metro Detroit area.
Okay, now I'm going to step in there. The way I met this young lady, I was at another event that was sponsored by WHFR. I guess I'll give them a little shout out. Jazz Horizons, they have a joint agreement with Burt's Downtown, and so they had their first affair about a couple months ago now. And at the time, Jabalon Jackson, who was one of the guest entertainers or musicians there, that's better, after she more or less presented herself and, you know, did her thing, she was very, very excited about this young person. I guess all of us who are over 30. But she was very, very excited about a young adult who had her own foundation. And this is Kendall Owens, all right? Okay. And so, Kendall, I'm going to let Kendall tell you a little bit about the organization, but kind of like tell how it came to be, because I'm going to cut her off a little bit because it's important to let us know about Kendall the person and then how it got into New Generation. Mm-hmm. So first, just give us an overview of New Generations a little bit.
Right, okay, so New Generation Fine Arts Foundation, we're really, our mission is just to provide greater accessibility and more opportunities for underserved ethnicities, developmentally disabled, and mentally ill young artists.
Okay, and you've been operating for how long now?
This will be our first year in operation,
okay.
So we're new.
All right, you are still in school?
Yes.
Okay, taking up what?
Dance and nursing, double majoring. It's keeping me busy, but I love them both, so.
All right, okay. That was my way of kind of giving you an idea of how old she was, because I might have asked her, well, I'm not going to tell you how old I am, okay? But I want you to get, just like DeBlanche, I'm very much impressed with the fact that she is a young adult, and she is on the initiation of a young adult, okay? So she's not, you know, young adult getting ready to be somebody old, okay? All right. Tell us a little bit about your career, you know, how, you know, your dancing, your music, and tell us a little bit about mm-hmm. that, because as I understood it, that had a lot to do with how you came about with New Generations, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I started dancing when I was about 8 years old, and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with tap dancing. So I did the studio thing. I danced at different studios. I did competitions. During my studio experience, there were two students there who had Down syndrome. So mm-hmm. I assisted with them. I started teaching dance when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
So moving up from there, I continued dancing, and then it was time for me to go to college. And before, like the year before my senior year when I was going to college, I just wanted to dance my life away. There wasn't really anything else that I was too gung-ho about.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom mentioned, you should try nursing. I was like, okay, nursing. I never thought about this. Like, I don't know.
Something's going to pay the bills.
So she mentioned nursing, and I was like, well, why would you say something like that? Why did you suggest that? And she said, because you like caring for other people. So if anybody in my family was sick or not feeling well, I was always like, well, let me make you some soup. Let me tuck you into bed. Let me make you feel better.
All right.
But she suggested nursing, so that's where nursing came from. So I was like, okay, I'm going to try it. So that's where the double major came in dance and nursing. And once I got into nursing, I fell in love with it. I love it.
All right. Now, you said the double major. So you were always had the two things going on, even when you first started college?
Yes. When I went into school, into Western Michigan University, I had the two majors.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I know. And what did your counselor say about that?
A lot of people were like, really? You want to do nursing? First of all, nursing, you want to pair that with another major? I was like, yeah. They're like, okay, we're most people don't do this, and I don't know if it's gonna work or how you'll succeed through it. And that was a question I got a lot all the time, like, how are you gonna do this?
Okay, let me ask you this. When you were going to flash back, check it out, we're flashing back to age 13. All right, when you said that you were helping someone who was Down syndrome,
yes.
What was that like? Now tell me the challenges about that.
It was really interesting because before I hadn't been teaching or anything, so I was just, the way in teaching somebody who has Down syndrome is different than somebody who doesn't. So it was just a different approach to how you teach, and it was very inspiring because they inspired me to do better. So,
all right.
Just the interaction between us, and I saw when they would get on stage how that would brighten up their day, or even come into like the dance class, it would just brighten up their day just to be there and just to dance. And it was just the overall great experience.
Okay. Now, you were saying, about them going from the lessons and then also getting to the performance. Mm-hmm. Now, you've had some performance experience yourself.
Yes.
You know, I'll share some of that. The reason why, and I hope I want helping my audience to understand, is that she has gone through a number of very positive experiences, mm-hmm. and this has also impacted the her foundation too. But I want the audience to get a sense of those kinds of things that you experienced, you know, the different awards and things that you got into. So why don't we kind of do it age-wise?
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, age. Okay. Okay. Right, let's okay. see. Where did I start? So let's just start at 13.
Okay. All right.
So
when she was a child.
Yes, when I was a baby. So at this time, I was doing competitions. Traveling within the country, doing different competitions.
Okay, so those competitions were? Which ones? Give me some
names. Oh my gosh, there's so many. Legacy competition, jump, dance competition. Kathy Rowe was a big one. We went to that one
all the
time.
Okay, now what's the distinctions about these competitions?
They're just dance competitions. So each one has their little, you know, thing about them. But most of them, you know, you go with your studio, whatever dance studio you dance at, you perform your dances and you get awards. So mm-hmm. you get like high gold, platinum, gold. Mm-hmm. So the highest was platinum, so that was what we were striving for. So get the platinum, Kendall. So yeah, at these different competitions that I would go to, I would get great awards for, you know, performance and opportunities to go to New York or mm-hmm. LA to dance and train from these competitions, from them seeing my dances, or also going to their national competitions and being in the special dance that they have for dancers that they would pick within the regional competition.
Yes.
To be in the big national production.
All right.
So I got invitations to that. I did that.
And when you say invitations, what do you mean?
So, like, you would go on stage and they see your dance and they would invite you to be part of this national dance.
Right.
So with that invitation, there was different people from different states within the country that would participate in this national dance.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned the training. What was involved in the training?
Well, the training, they had different choreographers at the Nationals. Some of the things that I was awarded scholarships to attend different training camps in New York, like Broadway, Steps, LA, just going and training with different people there. And from these experiences, I met other people, and that's how it started snowballing from there.
Okay. Those experiences, how did that impact your, now let me ask you, when you were training, I'll say tutor, okay, when you're tutoring other dancers or training, now which would you, was it both?
Training.
Okay, all right. See, as a person who can't, I know I can dance good, but I won't say anything about any competitions. All right, so that training experience, how did that imply or impact your training, say someone who's a Down syndrome or to someone who does not have a disability? What's the distinction?
Well, someone who does not have a disability, you can move at a quicker pace. Individuals with Down syndrome, it's a little bit a slower pace just to make sure they've got everything.
Right.
But there's no difference in how they learn. Like the style may be different, but they're able to retain just as somebody else would.
Right.
So it's just a little bit slower pace. Very clear and direct, and just more specific and clear.
When you are working with someone who, how's the impact for you? Because I know, as I've talked to people who teach, there's a certain gratification you get in person as they learn something and they can respond, and then it becomes their ownership. What does that do for you, the teacher?
It does a lot for me. It pushes me to keep going. It pushes me to do better so that I can offer more information and new styles or new ways of dancing or whatever we're doing, new for them, so that I can continue growing myself so that I can help them to grow as well. So when I see them get on stage or perform somewhere or even just in class and they're smiling, having a good time, it just warms my heart, like, okay, yes, this is what it's all about. It's not, you know, necessarily about, oh, we have to be the best. It's about what are you getting from it?
Like,
in life.
Right. So. When I was reading your bio, you were saying that you had the awareness or became aware of the fact that people who fall into the underserved, would that be a better good way of putting it?
Yes.
We're not getting the same thing that you were getting. Share some of that with us.
So that came from being able to travel to different festivals, so like going to New York, Chicago, LA, those different places, and I was blessed to get scholarships to go to these places, so it made it more affordable. So while I was there, I noticed that there weren't people who really looked like me, or it was just different. I was like, okay, well, I know back at home there are people who dance and who are proficient in the style and everything who deserve to come, but they're not here.
Right.
So that just made me think, like, what is the reason behind this? And then that's when I became aware that, okay, it is very expensive to do these types of things.
Right.
So as far as it being accessible, it's not really accessible to those who can't afford it because they can't even get there.
All right.
So the purpose of NewGen is to bring it here in the Metro Detroit area to make it more accessible for them and give them the opportunity to be exposed to the artistic inclination that they have in those different areas such as LA and New York.
All right. You've been to LA, New York. New Generations, now how did that come about?
So that came from me traveling to these different places and just being inspired by the artistry there and the artistic awareness of fine arts in general impacted or influenced me to create New Generation Fine Arts Foundation.
Now, give me examples. Try, because, you know, give us a word picture of...
Yes.
Okay.
So, let's see. For example, when I went to New York, I went to a tap dance festival because I love to tap dance.
Okay.
So, I was there and I was just surrounded by other tap dancers. And the culture of tap dance is not very present here in the Metro Detroit area.
Okay.
Well, as present as I think it should be, or it can be. So from being there around all these different tap dancers and feeling the unity and the love through the tap, I wanted that here and available to my fellow dancers who I know are here who dance too.
All right.
So I brought, like, for example, Jason Samuel Smith. I met him at a St. Louis Tap Festival. My mentor, Professor Robert L. Reed, he was a world-renowned tap dancer. He traveled. He was on Star Search. He had a festival in St. Louis, and that's how I met Jason Samuel Smith.
All right.
And he's also a tap dancer. So he'll be at our upcoming event, Black Box Teaching. So just meeting these different people has inspired me. Like, okay, yeah, you're doing that. We got to bring it here, because there are a lot of people in the Metro Detroit area who have talent and just need the exposure and the connections with the right people.
All right. Now, you're saying tap. Do you do any other forms of dancing?
Yes, I do. I do all types of forms, all different forms, all genres. Mm-hmm. I've done ballet, or I still do ballet, jazz, modern, tap, hip-hop.
Okay. Yeah. So are you just more or less bringing back to the awareness and the stage, and I didn't say community stage, mm-hmm. We use it that way, of the art of dance or the art of tap dance? Just what is it that you are focusing on?
Well, the focus is fine arts in general. So really, I think collaboration through the arts, not just dancers or not just vocalists. So we all can be inspired by each other. So I was inspired by another one of our artists who will be on faculty at Black Box.
All right.
His name is Johnson Simon. He has cerebral palsy, and he's an artist.
All right.
So I was inspired by him. So I think it's like a give and take effect. Like, you inspire me, I inspire you, and we all come together.
Okay. What was the inspiration of these particular people?
So Johnson Simon. So his story is just amazing. He shared at a seminar at Western Michigan University, just this story of living with cerebral palsy and being an artist and all the obstacles he had to face with, you know, advertisement. And it just inspired me that you can do whatever you set your heart to. You can do whatever what other people don't think you can do, you can still do it. So
right.
His art, he showed some of this, his art that he's also a commissioned artist. He showed some of that art, and I was inspired by it to continue cultivating my craft.
All right.
And collaborating with others to continue building fine arts in general.
All right. Then what was it that got to, from the inspiration, from the experience to new generation? Give me the history of how that evolved.
So the inspiration to the birth of new gen.
All right.
Okay,
here we go.
So I really think the inspiration just came from unity, the idea of unity through the arts.
All right.
And
when you say unity through the arts,
unity of all people. So no matter the ability, the color, location, just unity through the arts. Like, we can understand each other through music.
All right.
Or we can understand each other through dance, or just through
the
arts.
We can communicate through each
right,
other.
Right, exactly.
All right.
So that inspired me to want to create something, and it wasn't necessarily a nonprofit to begin with. It was just something that can unify all these people under the arts, because I think it has a very powerful impact, and it does connect people of all different types of walks.
All right.
So the nonprofit came when I think I just found out about nonprofits. Really, like, I knew what they were, but then I dug deeper into what a nonprofit was.
All right.
Okay, so nonprofits give back to the community, and everything that you get continues to go back into what you're working for.
Okay. Now, Kendall, we were started off about, you know, how New Generations came about. What is your position with the organization? Are you the chief executive officer? Just put it down. What is your?
I am the founder and executive director, CEO.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, back to how New Generations came. From the idea that you were had the, like I say, the seed for the idea, mm-hmm. and you said you learned some things about nonprofits. Mm-hmm. How did that process? What was the, you know, that process?
The process of wanting the nonprofit?
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting process. I had to learn a lot about how nonprofits operate and what exactly it was.
Okay, now let's stop, because you kind of like jump from When did you start trying to think or study or find out the information? What got you into that?
Oh, okay. So I think I mentioned the idea to someone, I can't remember exactly who it was, but I mentioned I wanted to do this idea, which was the idea of unity through the arts and providing different programs for it.
All right.
So they mentioned, well, why don't you try a nonprofit organization? And I was like, okay, well, I've heard about nonprofit organizations, so let me do more research and figure out what exactly that is. And that's what took me into finding out more about what a nonprofit is.
And what kind of things did you learn to find out?
I learned that there are so many different nonprofits that exist, and they really just give back and plant seeds in the community to help uplift and enrich the lives of others. Mm-hmm. So I wanted mine to be based on kids because the youth, you know, that's the future. And I really believe that it's important to continue cultivating their crafts and giving them the opportunities that they want and able to succeed in their dreams. So that's why I focused on youth.
Okay. And that was Kendall Owens from New Generations. Stay tuned for Voters, Not Politicians.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener supported, non-commercial radio.
Hi, this is Mike from Slumberland Records. I've always loved and appreciated college radio stations such as WHFR because they are one of the few places where you can hear a genuinely wide variety of music selected by people who are as passionate about it as you are. When I first started getting interested in underground music, college radio was a crucial, complementary part of a discovery mechanism that included fanzines and haunting the local record shops. While the internet has definitely changed all of that a little bit, when it comes to a source for new, and new to you, music from people who are an integral part of the local community, you really can't top college radio stations like WHFR.
Welcome back, and now we will hear from Katie Fahey following the approval and passing of Proposal 2. Good afternoon. This is Betty Daniels from Impact Fourth Tuesday, and I have on the line with me Katie, who was part of the effort to put forth the Voters Not Politicians on the December ballot, and as we know, that it was approved. So, Katie, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Hello, yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm Katie Fahey. I'm the founder and executive director of Voters Not Politicians. And we thankfully, on Election Day, successfully passed the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission here in Michigan so that in 2020, when we're redrawing the district lines that dictate who our congressional members, state Senate members, state House members are, voters and not politicians will be in charge of those decisions.
All right. Now, Katie, looking at the ballot, it passed by 61%. All right. Was that what you anticipated, or did you think it was going to be closer, or what?
Yeah, we were really glad to see that. We weren't surprised. It was really good to see. You know, our opposition had come out with some ads really late that were direct lies, so we're really glad that people saw past those. But wherever we were across the state of Michigan, when we were talking to Democrats, Republicans, Independents, people, you know, in rural counties or more urban counties, you know, a lot of people are upset with the state of politics. Mm-hmm. And they really want to end some of that corruption. And I think that seeing that we could change some of these systemic reasons why our government fails us was really exciting to a lot of people.
All right. So now that, you know, people do things in a fervor, you know, and masses are somewhat fickle. Okay, they'll be applauding you in the day, but then next, you know, if you don't do things exactly technically like they expected, you start getting some pushback. What are some of the, buyer's remorse kind of things that you think you may have to meet as you as this goes along from here? Are you understanding what my question is?
Yeah. I think, you know, as long as people participate in the process, I don't think that we'll have problems.
Okay.
A big part of this policy was like making sure that the public could participate, that people could not only attend these meetings, but apply to be on the commission, could watch online. And I think as long as we do a good job helping people know that they can do that and people participate, I actually think they'll be really happy and surprised with how thoughtful these commissioners will end up being.
All right. Now, the current gerrymandering that, you know, that occurred during this election, how will that be impacted? Can you tell us?
Yeah. So right, the status quo previously was, so our lines have been drawn in a way before where the politicians who are running for office, whichever party happens to be in control, actually gets to draw their own lines.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was in office and you were running against me and I like knew where you lived, I could actually draw you out of the district. So you'd have to go run in a different district.
So what?
Pretty crazy.
Okay. So what do you think that they're going to be doing now that this proposal has been approved? Because like right now they are in office because of the gerrymandering.
What? Right. Exactly.
Okay. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Instead of the politicians drawing their own lines, we actually are going to have a 13-member commission of regular citizens from across the state. They actually can't be elected partisan politicians or registered lobbyists. They should be, you know, representative of the state. So, you know, people of different economic incomes, different races, different political beliefs coming together to draw these lines together. And they have really strict rules that they'll have to follow that guarantees that, you know, one party can't have an advantage and that how these lines are drawn should actually represent the communities of Michigan as well as how the people of Michigan vote.
Okay, so but now the ones, what I was getting at was that the ones who were elected as a result of the existing gerrymandering process, when will they feel the impact of the new gerrymandering system? That was the question I was trying to get to. So,
got it. Yeah, okay. So these lines get redrawn once every 10 years after the census. The next census is in 2020, where they'll count up the whole population of Michigan so we can make sure that the numbers we're using to redraw these lines are accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So the lines will be redrawn in 2021, and the first election where they will be used is 2022.
All right. Now, is there going to be some type of voter education, I guess is might be a way of saying it, so that the voters will say, well, wait a minute, we voted for changes and these people are still doing this kind of thing. So is there going to be some things of voter education so that people can know that, okay, this is going on right now, but this is what you can look forward to?
Yeah, I know that Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson is very active and interested in doing that, but so is voters, not politicians. And actually, if anybody out there wants to help make sure their community or friends and family know about this, or maybe they're part of an organization that wants to make sure that their members know about this, at votersnotpoliticians.com, people can sign up. But our organization is going to be championing making sure people know that they can apply for the commission, making sure that they know that they can go and attend those meetings, and also making sure that people know how they can go and talk about their community in an effective way so that the commissioners can use that information when drawing the lines. The really crazy part is, like, for the first time, this process, which normally is controlled by only a couple people, will be opened up to millions of Michiganders to be able to participate.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure that we're helping people understand how, because we've never had this opportunity before.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that fact that, you know, Mrs. Johnson, I can get her title correctly, because there were so many different new women, which is another kind of landmark kind of thing that happened this past election. What will the election official position or their impact, you know, involvement in this process, will they have to be, you know, make sure that, you know, certain information is gotten out? I mean, is it going to be a collaborative effort between you and them, or are you going to just be is your organization going to be spearheaded? I think I heard you say that you're going to be doing spearhead a lot of it. So is it going to be a collaborative effort between you and the official state?
We certainly certainly hope so, yeah. And I believe the Secretary of State's office has, you know, led it to believe that, you know, they're going to lead with integrity. Really, their part is making sure that applications will be available and also making sure that it's advertised and people know about this opportunity to apply. Mm-hmm. The commission will act and operate completely independently, but technically they'll be housed in the Secretary of State's office.
Okay, which was part of the issue in the first place about the independent functioning of the commission, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. That's why we wanted to make sure they can operate differently. Just technically, again, like where their budget will come from and stuff is housed under the Secretary of State. But they have all of that guaranteed in this constitutional amendment, which is why it was so important that we voted it in and included all those details in the proposal that got passed.
Yes. Now, I noticed that, you know, prior to the election, there were a lot of court challenges and things like that that went through, you know, trying to first not even get it on the ballot and then other kinds of things like that. Are there still some court opposition or challenges that you have to fine to and, you know, put in its place now after the election?
Yeah, right now there isn't, which is really great. We did make it past the Michigan Supreme Court before putting this on the ballot.
Okay.
And so we are excited to be there and hope that this will just continue to work and people will be able to apply and use the commission.
Okay. All right. Now, when, okay, now from your point of view, because I know you have to prepare for the census and all that kind of stuff. What are some of the things that your organization will be working on getting ready for, you know, when the census goes through, that type of thing? I know you do, we got the, you know, commissioners and stuff to do. What are some of the other things that you'll be working on trying, you know, coming up with the 2020 process?
Yeah, there's a lot of really great organizations that'll be really focused on the census, which means that we want to make sure everybody in Michigan is counted.
Okay.
You know, that takes into account people who are going to help collect those numbers, but especially, you know, there's some populations that are harder to count than others.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to make sure that each of those hard to reach populations is still counted, because a lot of government funding from the national level, even on the in-state level, also derives from, like, how many people your state or your city has.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to make sure that that's accurate for that, but we also want to make sure it's accurate for drawing these lines for redistricting, so that when we even create that commission, it's actually representative. Because if we don't have an accurate kind of, you know, who is in our state, then we can't really know if it's accurate or not for representation.
Will that mean that your body will be involved in trying to help assist, you know, the census taking process? I know these people, they ask, you know, the census, it used to be, you know, people go to door to door. Now there's a lot of mail in. And mm-hmm. one of the challenges was is that mail in thing, you lose a lot of people because not everybody will respond to the mail in. Well,
yeah. I think we're hoping to definitely help with that process, help with education around it and getting more awareness out there. You know, we might help with going door to door to try and educate people. Some of that's still being decided based on, like, what other great organizations in the state of Michigan are doing and where we need help. But I think one thing we were really good at is we have volunteers in all 83 Michigan counties.
Okay.
And so, you know, if there's less bodies somewhere, can we try and, you know, reach out to people and let them know that this is an opportunity to help make sure everybody's counted.
Okay. Now, I see here that the legislature has to vote money for the commission. Is that a hurdle that you think you're going to have to, challenge, you know, with all these different things going on?
Part of how we worded it was that it would be equal to 25% of the Secretary of State's budget.
Okay.
So as long as the government doesn't, like, severely underfund that, which we certainly hope that they don't, because it would really impact, you know, our ability to get driver's licenses and also have our elections done on time, we should be okay. That's how we tried to think about that, though. But, of course, it is really important that we actually get a budget passed so that, you know, money can be appropriately spent on this commission to make sure that it's done the right way.
Okay. What committee or what group is with the one that will be addressing that budget?
The legislature.
The legislature body. Okay, so there's not a separate,
yeah.
Is it like a committee that's been assigned to that task or certain?
I think there is, yeah, a budgetary committee, but ultimately everybody has to vote on it, and I believe the governor has to approve it.
So. Oh, okay, all right. Now, you said the commission will go into effect January 2020, correct?
Yep, January 1st of 2020, the applications will be made available for people to start applying.
Okay.
And then by July, the final commissioners will be chosen, and then they'll really spend that time as well as the majority of 2021 going across the state, listening to people and communities to then start drawing these lines.
Okay. Can you anticipate what the agenda of that first meeting will be about?
Of the commission?
Yes.
Yeah, so the commission will have to decide, like, rules and procedures. So one of the ways that they will pass their final maps is at least 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, and 2 Independents all have to agree on whatever that, you know, criteria
Okay.
And so my guess would be their first commission meeting is probably going to be talking about those different procedures. They're going to have to hire expertise and staff. And what we saw in other states is they made, you know, self-rules following a similar pattern where, like, they'd want 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, 2 Independents to all agree on whatever consultant they have or something like that.
All right. Now, and just as a refresher course, if there happens to be – all right, let me – there's 2 questions in 1. If I remember the process, the commission is set up so that you won't get a stalemate kind of a thing where, you know, mm-hmm. they had to go into, you know, we could not agree, that kind of a thing. Am I correct mm-hmm. on that?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. And explain that to our listening audience just to refresh, you know, because – you know, it's like after the fanfare, we had to go back now. Okay, now what we're talking about?
Okay. Yeah. Well, the commission really has to follow some strict criteria that tell them how these lines have to be drawn. But there is some discretion within that, especially when you're listening to different community testimony.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at least 2 of the Democrats, 2 of the Republicans, 2 of the Independents will need to agree on a final map.
Okay.
If for some reason they are having a stalemate or, you know, that doesn't happen, there's a process called ranked choice voting that they will use where they'll take all of the final map options because, like, one of them's got to be it, and they'll actually rank in order of their preference which one they like, you know, the best, which one they like second best, third best, fourth best.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, all of those numbers on, you know, who is everybody's number one, everybody's number two, and number three helps create a process of elimination to figure out where the consensus is around maps.
Okay.
So that you would still get that buy-in from everybody and find, you know, the best map. But what we've seen in all the other states that have these commissions is because these people are not politicians,
all
because
right.
they are there doing their civic duty. You know, they've been listening to communities across the whole state for like over a year. They really see it as their job to deliver this result. And we've actually never seen a stalemate happen in any other state, although we do have the backup.
All right. Now, the next question, there were about like 5 or 6 other states. I'm sorry, I might not remember the exact number, but the voters, not politicians, was approved on all of those states.
Yeah, so for the 2018 election, Michigan, Missouri, Colorado, and Utah all decided to make it, yeah, so that politicians are no longer drawing these lines and that either a commission is or a computer algorithm, but basically they're moving that power so that hopefully we can eliminate gerrymandering.
All right. Are there some sort of distinctions between the different states, as you know, because of how a proposal was written or how the state is set up that is unique and distinctive from what we're going through?
Yeah. So each state did craft a policy that really reflected their own. For example, in Missouri, they are using kind of a panel of people, but with a nonpartisan computer algorithm that
mm-hmm.
will, you know, be based on some independent criteria that will help decide these maps, where ours is more, although computers will be used, it's includes a lot more public testimony and public participation
okay.
for people to be able to come and comment and talk about their own community. In Utah, you know, they have a lot less, smaller population. So theirs is a little bit different. I think also in Missouri, I believe they only passed it for their congressional lines, so they still maybe need to do their in-state lines. Or I might have that mixed up, but those
okay.
are kind of the differences.
Okay. Now, but you also touched on another question that I had. It was that now that, you know, we've got the proposal, we've got the commission, how would the voters, you know, the person there or they're on the front line, if you will, how are they going to participate in it? And as you were sharing about the different states, I understand you said something about public meetings and that type of thing. Is that how?
Yeah. So anybody who's a registered voter, as long as, again, they aren't disqualified from being a, you know, elected partisan politician, a lobbyist closely related to them, there's a couple other things, can actually apply to be on the commission. So that's the first way you can participate is, you know, you can actually put your name in the hat to be one of these commissioners.
Okay.
Another way is these commissioners are required to have all open meetings, and they're also required to have at least 10 meetings before they even start drawing these maps across the state. So they have to go travel, and basically their job is to listen, to listen to people on, you know, why would they, how do they want these lines being drawn? And that's a big part with public participation. So you making sure that whatever that closest meeting is, you can show up and give testimony to say, like, why and how you would define your community so that you want that representation in Lansing and in Washington, D.C. Another thing is, because this commission will have to operate in a completely transparent way, it's very likely that their meetings will be posted online. They'll be taking public comment online. So people can also, you know, if they have access to a computer, log online, watch these meetings, send comments, and the commissioners will have to respond to those too, which is another way that they can participate. Any maps that the commission draws, they have to make public. So, you know, if you feel like something fishy is going on, you can go in and you can look at those maps and see, you know, what the conversation is, when right now all that's done behind closed doors. You have no idea what's being said or why these lines are being drawn the way they are.
Okay. And you were saying, you know, you were also touching base. You kind of like anticipating my questions over here. And I feel like she's getting ahead of me. But, you know, looking at the political lines and that type of thing, is there a room for the independent voter and their opinions?
Yeah. So for the commissioner, the initial even makeup of it will be 13 members. Four of those are from the majority party, four from the minority, and then five are from independent or third-party voters. So what that will most likely look like in 2020 is four Democrats, four Republicans, and five independent or third-party voters who are actually on this commission.
Okay.
And another big part is, with how these lines will be drawn, we actually make it illegal for them to be drawn based on trying to benefit one political party over another, which I think really helps independent voters because they can go and talk about more how they want those lines to be drawn based on their community and how and the issues that are important to them. So let's say you're really concerned about the water in your community. Well, you probably want to make sure that, you know, all of your neighbors that share your same water source are in one district so that your state representative is actually listening to your concerns instead of them having to listen to 20 different communities, which is with these crazy lines how communities are carved up right now.
All right. Now, and I may be kind of like going up our field. You know, we recently, you know, we had this thing with the plant crisis, and there was a lot of input, you know, finger pointing that, you know, at, you didn't do your job, you didn't do your job, that kind of a thing. Will those kind of issues be part of what the commissions will be addressing, or is that something that is still back with the voters and this another venue altogether?
Do you mean for like the accountability piece or like the concerns around?
I would say both. But and if so, you know, how you know, yes or no to each one of those questions.
Got it. Okay, yeah. So when it comes to like accountability in government, I think that this, although it won't 100% fix it, I think it sets a really good tone and example of how government could be run.
Okay.
Because this commission will actually do everything out in the open. You know, a big part with the Flint water crisis was there are hidden emails. There are people making decisions and talking about things completely private and then hiding that information. We are the voters and the taxpayers of this state. You know, we should be able to see what's going on, have responsiveness, and therefore have some accountability. This commission will operate completely transparent. Like, any email they send will be made public probably instantly. And so I think, like, by changing how that looks, and thankfully we were able to because the voters voted to put this into place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that will hopefully show people that there is a different way of doing things. And also, I think the court of public opinion will help hold those commissioners accountable. When it comes to things like concerns about your community, let's say, you know, you are from Flint and those are one of your top concerns is like, you know, the fact that nobody still has taken accountability or that, you know, you want to make sure that this actually gets fixed. you know, Flint is a gerrymandered community, just like, you know, all the other ones in Michigan.
Right.
But going and making sure that when you're going to these public meetings, you're saying, you know, here's how I would define my community. Here are our concerns. We want to make sure that they get heard. That commission would probably take that information and try and make sure that with the level of decision making where that's actually impacted, so probably like a state house and a state senate level, that that community is actually kept together,
mm-hmm.
so that when they do stand up and use their collective voice, they have somebody listening who's actually going to fight for them in Lansing.
All right. Another entity that doesn't exist in the Voting Rights Act. How will the commission, the new commission, impact the Voting Rights Act, or does the Voting Rights Act impact the commission?
Yeah, so the Voting Rights Act, because it's a federally mandated law, will impact the commission and its ability to draw these lines. So that was not done away with. The kind of really, I think, good thing is that with the Voting Rights Act, it basically guarantees majority and minority communities in Michigan to be able to elect somebody from their community. But how it's been abused in the past has been overly packing minorities into one district.
Okay.
You know, a majority means you only need 51% of a vote to win. And you want to still guarantee representation, but that doesn't mean that you pack in as many minorities as possible so that, you know, everybody's voting 80-90% one way, because people live in different communities and their voices deserve to be heard, and then it makes less of those voices heard in other districts, so that you're really limiting their ability to only elect one person when really maybe they could help elect two or three representatives.
All right.
Yeah, and so then this commission will need to still guarantee those majorities, but again, we'll hopefully do it in a much more thoughtful way that actually still stays and keeps the integrity of the community being represented in multiple places.
All right. So challenges to the, the commission, met, they did set up their things like that, and there's still a group that wants to challenge what the commission did or did not do. Could you explain that process? Let's say they came up with they came up with the maps.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So yes, of course. So like, even though we've put in all of these safeguards, we want to make sure that these maps are done with integrity. So just like the maps right now, if somebody is still really concerned that they were done the wrong way, or maybe somebody was using bias when drawing them, which would be illegal, you could bring a lawsuit against the current set of maps, and then the courts would have to evaluate, you know, what were the criteria that's spelled out in the Constitution followed or not. Right now, there's a lawsuit going against the current way maps are drawn, which is by our legislators. You know, there's emails that have been leaked out where they even directly said they're trying to, you know, cram all of one party's garbage into one district over another. It was very unsettling, I think. And that's where, again, what we see in other states that have passed something similar to what we passed in Michigan is, although, you know, some people will probably still try and bring a lawsuit because they're just going to be mad that, like, you know, their party has less seats or whatever.
I want to take my ball and come home.
Yeah, exactly. That once, because this process is done out in the open, you're not discovering emails 10 years later. It's all done right there. And usually those cases are actually quickly dismissed, and it ends up saving the state money because it's actually done in a fair way. It's just people being upset that, yeah, exactly, they want to take their ball and go home and try and stop it because they're used to being able to manipulate it themselves.
All right. Okay. Now, is there a precedence for a commission like this? Has, you know, some other state already had operationalized this, and how is it working?
Yeah. So one state that is a good example, I think, is Arizona and California. So what they have is a chair who really helps run the meetings when they have the meetings, but they actually rotate that chair, and then they often have a vice chair. So normally what they'll do is they'll have, you know, one of the political parties, let's say the Democrat, be the chair, and then the Republican will be the vice chair. And every meeting, or every month, I think, maybe they'll switch, actually, like, who's that next one. So maybe the Republican becomes the chair, and then an independent member becomes the vice chair. And that's one way they try and change up that power dynamic so nobody can really have more of a say than the others.
Okay. All right. The Voters Not Politicians group, you started off as an advocacy group. Would that a good way to describe you?
We actually accidentally started with a Facebook post.
I remember that, but now that you've gotten past your pablum stage, okay?
Yeah.
And you're a full vested body. After the commissions are set up and run, will your job be done, or do you see yourself continuing on doing some more things?
I think we're definitely going to continue on and do more things. We definitely want to make sure that this commission is put into place with integrity. But, you know, we want to also be setting precedents for in 2030, when they're drawing the next set of lines, that we're taking everything we learned and the process gets improved every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, though, our campaign really focused on empowering people. This is only possible because thousands of people across the state really took time, energy, resources to step up and say, you know, this isn't right with the government. Now, how are we going to change the system to fix it? And I think we hope to just continue bringing people together to do that, because there are a lot of hurdles when you're trying, but it's not impossible when you can work together. And we want to hopefully make it easier for the people who come after us wanting to, you know, create whatever change they want to see in the world.
Do you also see yourself, your group, as a organization that will, you know, show people how, and I think you kind of said it in your answer just now, that how us, you know, one person, one idea, one small group can make a difference. Do you see yourself as part of getting that message to the general population in general? So, because, I mean, that's a lesson I think that if anything else that came out of this election is that, you know, an interest group that saw a need and you start to apply yourself. What were some of the, you know, how did you go about it? You know, what were some of the challenges, you know? So do you see your group getting involved in something like that?
Yeah, we've had the really exciting part about, you know, being an organization that started from a Facebook post and then was really run by like thousands of regular people is we did get highlighted, and we even got some national press. So we've had a lot of people who've read about us or heard about us actually reach out saying, you know, in their state, they want to try and end gerrymandering, or they have a different issue they're passionate about and they want to know how we did it. And I think we all took it as a really big responsibility to pay it forward and to help people navigate those challenges. You know, it's always going to be different in a different state with a different issue,
mm-hmm.
but I think there are some things that we learned that can be applied and hopefully helpful to others. You know, we created a big training network, a lot of like materials on how to gather petitions. We cut 6,000 clipboards, and any of those ways that we can try and just be helpful. It was really hard to create all of that from scratch, and I think part of our motivation even while we were doing it was, you know, knowing that we could hopefully make it easier for the people who come next.
Yes, and I noticed that at least the Dearborn League of Women Voters were supportive of you during this venture.
Yeah, they were very supportive.
Okay. Do you see continuing collaborative efforts with them in particular?
Yeah, you know, I really anticipate that. I'm pretty sure the league is planning on doing some census work, although you want to check directly with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the really key part to being able to reach people across the state in all different types of communities between now and 2020 to make sure that they apply for this commission, but also that people want to participate in these meetings, will be working with a really expansive coalition of different groups who get the word out and let people know about these opportunities, but who also can, you know, help educate and reach more people than we could on our own.
All right. Katie, is there anything that I left out or that you think is really important for the people, the listeners to know about?
I'm trying to think. No, I think, I mean, if people want to stay updated on, you know, I'm sure the Secretary of State's website will eventually have information about the commission and when applications will be coming out, but voters, not politicians, for sure will. We have an email, you know, update list where if anything happens in the courts or anything happens with deadlines, we let people know. So, It is a brand new process. It isn't tomorrow, but it is going to be soon. I bet 2020 will be here before we know it. So
yes, indeed.
Yeah. So we're happy to help, you know, guide people that way. And we need help. We need you making sure your community is going to be represented no matter where you live.
Okay. All right. One thing I did not address, although we kind of like, you know, touched base with it. How much of an impact did social media play in this campaign?
Yeah, you know, I think it played a really big aspect, especially when we were first organizing. You know, we didn't have a bank account. We didn't have money. So we certainly didn't have an office, printers, anything like that. And organizing online became really key. A big thing, too, is, you know, like when you're in a company or an organization, you can set up new systems and work with, like, you know, like a Microsoft system or whatever. But that's not, like, really accessible for a lot of people. And so being able to use a platform people use every day, like a Facebook or a Twitter or an Instagram, I think was really key to being able to keep people comfortable with figuring out how can they be activists, you know, not having to, like, make people go out on a brand new platform or something. I think continuing to do that. And it also helped create a sense of community where, you know, maybe there weren't a lot of other volunteers in your part of the state, but you could see that there were, you know, hundreds and then thousands of people working in other parts of the state just as hard as you were working here in your spot. I think that was just motivating. It was cool to see how many thoughtful people were who are in Michigan, but also who are, like, you know, putting, doing the grind every day just like you were.
All right. How much time was invested in your social media? You know, was it a part of your campaign strategy, or did it, you know, or was this a part of, like, an ongoing blog kind of thing? What kinds of things were going on with your social media effort?
Yeah, I mean, eventually we could pay to help at least do, like, some advertising, because that is another good part about social media. You can reach different audiences and do a lot of targeting that way. But because we use it as our main platform for communicating, especially internally, I think a lot of us helped at the upkeep. We had a, on Facebook in particular, like a private group where we would discuss a lot of stuff, and we had different committees which would then have, you know, their own groups so that they could keep track of the conversations. And then, you know, we had to be careful, though. We had to lay down some rules because we are nonpartisan and people are very passionate, especially about the president, whether they like him or don't like him. And so we really wanted to make it a space where anybody could feel comfortable. And so we had to monitor that. We would have different volunteers who helped, you know, remind people that, you know, what they were saying was a little partisan and that, like, that's probably best for outside of the group and they're allowed to have those opinions. But in this group, we really wanted to focus on how we come together, even though we have differences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we always tried to encourage people too, you know, when we were doing goals or, you know, we'd have a goal like, you know, we want everybody to go do a door knocking shift today. We'd ask people to post pictures because then you are, again, like, seeing other people doing it. And sometimes it encourages you to want to go out there.
All right. Now, Facebook, no, I'm sorry, your social media presence is most prominent where?
Yeah, Facebook, at Voters Not Politicians. We're also on Twitter, which is, our handle is @NotPoliticians. And we have a good Instagram page, too, which is Voters Not Politicians.
All right, so I'm going to ask you to repeat that a little bit slower so people who are listening will, might want to kind of, like, you know, that might be their way of connecting with you. So repeat again your media contact information.
Yeah, so for Facebook, it's Voters Not Politicians. If you, that's our public page. On Twitter, our handle is @NotPoliticians. And on Instagram, we can be found through Voters Not Politicians.
All right. Are there blogs involved in that as well?
We do have a blog, yeah. So if you go to our website, which is votersnotpoliticians.com or VNP for votersnotpoliticians.vote, so VNP.vote or votersnotpoliticians.com, we have a blog linked right off of the main page of that.
All right. And just in case we haven't gotten everything, if all of the above, they didn't, how would they get in touch with Voters Not Politicians again? Is there a telephone number?
Yes.
And slowly, slow down.
Kate. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, probably the best way would be our website at votersnotpoliticians.com, or you can email us at info@votersnotpoliticians.com.
Okay. Does the Voters Not Politician have a time when they meet outside, you know, where the people can do a, you know, put a body to that face and they can be, you know, interact with you at some time, at that point?
Yeah, we have local meetings as necessary across the state, as well as statewide conference calls. The best way to get connected really is through signing up on our website. If you sign up to volunteer, we'll connect you with a local team that can let you know what their meeting schedule is.
Okay. All right. Well, Katie, I want to thank you very much for your input and for your fatherland. And you still got the same enthusiasm after the elections. Did you go to sleep?
Feels good that we won too. I think. I think that makes it easier.
Did you sleep for a week after the elections?
I actually just got back from a 2-week vacation where I only actually got to take vacation like 7 of the days, but that was still better than none. So.
Oh, and another aside, how has this venture changed your, you know, you had a life before voters, not politicians. How has that life been impacted by that, by what you've been going through?
I mean, I used to be in the recycling industry. So I think for a starter, because I somehow wound up in politics, even though I don't like politics. But honestly, you know, I think, like 2 years ago when I was looking at Michigan, I kind of wanted to move out of the state. I didn't feel like it was headed in a direction that supported young people. And I didn't really feel like, you know, people shared my same values. And then over the last 2 years, I've just gotten to meet so many amazing people who, you know, spent their time trying to make the world better for 2 years. And I think if anything, I've just never felt, you know, better about the state of things and just knowing how impactful people power really can be. It was super inspiring. And I think I just have like a much like brighter perspective on like what we can really do to try and make things better.
All right. Voters Night Politicians, you are a nonprofit, correct?
Yeah, we're a 501c3 and a C4.
Okay. And is that something that came about as you got into this, or was that how you started out beforehand?
Yeah, so when you're doing a ballot initiative in Michigan, before you raise over $500, you have to file a ballot question committee. So we actually started as a ballot question committee, but that makes only your treasurer legally liable for everything, which was me. So we quickly became a C4 so that we could offer that protection. And then as we really were looking at all the education work that we have to do and want to do post-election, that's when we created our C3 as well, so that we could really have that focus on making sure the word gets out.
And so this is Betty Daniels from Impact on Fourth Tuesday, thanking Katie from Voters Not Politicians, and look forward to seeing you again next Fourth Tuesday.
Listeners supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Guys and dolls, you are at the malt shop with Daddy G. That's me. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror. Grab your favorite squeeze and head on down to the malt shop where the jukebox is playing. And the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.